Hey, y'all. Welcome to the Working Dog Wednesday Show on the Fueled by Joy Working Dog Podcast, brought to you by Joy Dog Food. Now, I'm your host, Mike Green. I'm the owner and operator of Cottonville Road Kennels, located in Norwood, North Carolina. I want to let you know, for more information about Joy Dog Food or to find a Joy dealer near you, visit joydogfood.com. Now let's get on to the show.
Fuel your dog with power. Fuel them with strength. Fuel them with Joy Super Meal 3020. Joy Super Meal is made for the hardest working dogs. With a colossal 510 kcals per cup, magnesium for muscle repair, and pumpkin for digestive health. This formula is made specifically for gaining muscle mass and added endurance. Our Super Meal 3020 is also great for breeders and offers mothers extra calcium and magnesium to assist with whelping. For dogs that work just as hard as you do, make sure to fuel them with the best. Fuel them with Joy Super Meal 3020. To learn more about Joy Super Meal 3020 or to find a dealer near you, visit joydogfood.com or give us a call at 800-245-4125.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike Green. I'm your host today for the Fueled by Joy Working Dog Podcast. And today is Working Dog Wednesday. As always, I want to remind you that if you ever want to reach out with concerns, questions, or comments, you can email me at mike@joydogfood.com. And just like the advertisement said there before we got started, the intro said, you can always look up joydogfood.com. You can go on there and find out information, nutritional values, and things like that about the dog food. Where even you can even get on there and find places to retailers where you can find it to buy it. And so, again, you can email me at mike@joydogfood.com. And as the emails come in, I will answer them as best as I can. And if you have a suggestion or comment or any questions like that, feel free to follow that. I just want to welcome you again to this. We've got a special show today. I'm glad you're tuning in all across the United States and around the world. And because tonight, today we've got a friend of mine on here, Dexter Raffitz. Now, many of you will recognize that name. If you don't know the owner and operator of Raffitz Kentucky Mountain Kennel, you're going to recognize that name because you've seen it in many pedigrees over the years. I don't think I've seen too many pedigrees around lately that didn't have something on there that was Raffitz Kentucky Mountain. And so we want to welcome you to the show, Dexter, and I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you taking out your time, your day, being here on the show with me. A lot of people that I've let know that you're going to be on here, they have bombarded me with 100 questions, things, ask this and ask that. Well, I'm not going to say that we're going to ask all them questions, but I'm pretty confident that they're going to get answered in the process. So, Dexter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it is a pleasure and honor to be on here with you. A name that goes without saying is Raffitz. We know what we don't know about it is how it all got started. Now, some people may know, some people may have an idea, but I always like to reach into the history of a particular kennel and kind of understand how that went together. Now, I know you got a lot of history. And there's a lot. So if we don't get it all in, we'll just record again. We'll do a part two and just keep on getting it till we can get it all in. But I know that you got a lot, and I am thankful for you being able to be on here. So how about just go ahead and get in there, just introduce yourself and tell us a little about yourself there, some things that may be something people don't know about you.
Well, you already introduced who I am, Mike, so basically, there was never a time in my life that I wasn't associated with or that there wasn't hunting, some type of hunting dog around. I'm from Eastern Kentucky, the Appalachians, and my family has been in Appalachia for between 6 and 7 generations. So I'm a born and bred mountaineer, I guess, but my family were always involved in hunting dogs. My father was a coal miner And he was a child of the Depression, so he lived in a time when the hunting dog was an integral part of the family. I mean, they depended on those dogs to actually supplement the food that they raised themselves.
Right.
So from a child, I've always had, there's always been hounds and fice and curs and whatnot, but that is my background with hunting dogs. And as far as the beagles are concerned, I probably got my first beagle when I was about 9. It was a gray dog, but I was tickled to death with her. I thought she was a world beater, obviously, as a 9-year-old.
Right.
And she was a fair rabbit dog. But anyway, I stayed with beagles until I was a preteen, and then my brother was an avid coon hunter, and coon hunted for many years. And after that, I got back into beagles. And I'd never had any registered beagles. And here in this area of eastern Kentucky, the only beagles we saw back then were brace rejects.
So,
and when someone said that they had a papered beagle, was what, you know, a papered dog, they called a registered dog back then, they automatically knew that they were probably pretty worthless as far as hunting dogs. But when I quit coon hunting, because the coon population had dropped so much here, I was determined to find registered dogs that were good hunting dogs.
Yeah.
And so I went through various bloodlines and was fortunate enough to get a female, and I had some pretty decent hounds, or I thought I did. But I was fortunate enough to get a female from a guy in Michigan. Tom Dickman had raised a litter of pups from Northway Spur, and I got a female, and she was just an ordinary red and white female. I mean, nothing fancy to look at, but by the time she was 9 months old, she was better than anything I had. So I ended up culling the entire pack but her. And she was, her mother was a female called Chippewa Abbey that Tom had raised, Tom Dickman had raised. He lived in Deerfield, Michigan. And she was out of Misty Mountain Palantir in False Patty's Liz. Now, Liz was a female out of the UP of Michigan, and she was line-bred Mount Zion Pete with a cross of Dom's Dougie in her. And Misty Mountain Palantir was a line-bred Pete dog also. He had two wins on him towards champion and got hit by an automobile, and they had to put him down. But before that happened, Tom had bred to him and produced Abby, which he later bred to Spur, and that's where my original female, Chime, came from.
Hmm.
And like I said, she was everything. Well, not everything I wanted, because do we ever get everything we want?
No.
she was a good jump dog. She was tough. She ran a good line, had a beautiful mouth, and gave plenty of it when the time was right. And when it come time to breed her, I actually sent her back to Paul Cremorne's and bred her to her half-brother, Northway Driver, who had just finished in the international field champion at the time. And that was the beginning of a friendship that Paul and I have even to this day. And so that was the beginning. That's where Samson came from. Samson and Sarah and several other good dogs. It was a good litter. But that's, I guess, the beginning. So I'll leave it at that and let you.
Well, you know, you answered like five of the questions that I had that people was asking, you know, hey, ask him this or ask him that, you know, and so you answered that there with that. So that dog, that female you got that was, now let me make sure that I'm following you right here. And I'm trying to take notes while I'm, that's one good thing about being the host. I get to take notes, and if I miss something, we can back up and let's cover that again. So I'll make sure that I got the information right on this end. So, so the dog that you got was, Misty's Mountain Palantar.
Well, the dog that I got was a pup out of Chippewa Abbey, who was out of Chippewa Abbey was my Chime was the bitch's name.
Oh yeah.
She was out of Chippewa Abbey in Misty Mountain Palantar.
Okay. All right. So she was out, so Chime was out of that, and Chime's where Samson came from.
Yes.
Okay. All right. I've got you now. I've got you. It's like, look, I'm right here in the room with you, and it's still so. I know. Look, another advantage of being recorded on podcasts is for those of you that are listening, you can back it up and try it again. You know, so you make sure that we got all that straight right there. So, and Mount Zion Pete was the daddy to Misty Mountain Palantar.
No. By that, see. Mount Zion Pete was born, let me think here, February the 25th of 1955, I think.
Hold on, Dexter. Look, when I talk about my dogs, and I say, well, that dog was born somewhere around August of 15. You said February the 25th of 1958, did you say? 55, man. You got a memory on you, boy. That's pretty good right there, brother.
Well, you know, I've lived it for roughly 40 years. So,
right.
You start to, what's the old saying? Even a blind hog can find an acorn every now and then. If you do it enough, you'll start to remember. But I've always had a knack for remembering things about dogs that I like. But anyway, back to the question. Pete would have been dead, long dead by then.
Oh yeah.
But he was owned by Homer LeMay, up around Detroit, Michigan, and he was a very prominent stud in his time, and produced a lot of good dogs. And the Northern Hunters, there's few bloodlines that don't have some connection to Pete somewhere.
Right.
And they had great success crossing the Pete stuff in later years with the Dom's Dougie stuff, who was in the same area, as I recall, of Michigan. But it sprung many families through Pete, like Homer LeMay. He bred the Pete dogs until he was too old to breed and passed away. But then the Birch Lake dogs have a Pete background. The Meacham stuff. A lot of the Michigan Hirehounds have Pete backgrounds. Now he was also used in Canada and on the East Coast because. You had the Bushy brothers,
yep.
who had the Pete dogs also and concentrated on that. And skipping back to Chime, a couple of years after breeding her to Driver, I actually bred her to Grandpa Mr. T, who was the top stud at that time. And Tom and I, Tom Sharp and I become friends, and he actually kept and ran a hound for me while I ran one of the young, a young Grandpa Mr. T-Dog for him. I wanted my dog Ran on her, and he wanted his dog Red on a Cottontail. So we worked together somewhat through the years, and Tom was a great houndsman.
Yeah.
But anyway, did I answer all that question?
Oh yeah. Now
okay.
Now so you bred Chime to Driver, and that's where now what were the main dogs that you got out of that one out there?
Well, the main dogs that I had Samson, Sarah,
mm-hmm.
And there was a female called Kate that was a good producer. It was a nice hound and a good producer. Cody's Punchin' Creek Chico came out of that cross. There was a dog called Solomon and Levi, and a dog called Moses. That was the litter.
Okay. So we got Levi and Solomon and Samson and Sarah. I believe all them's in the Bible somewhere.
I was doing the Bible.
Yeah, I see that. I see the connection right here. And then you also bred Chime to Round Pond Mr. T. Now, Round Pond Mr. T's been very well known over the years. And mm-hmm. So what was some of the things that you got out of that? What were some of the dogs you got out of that?
I got an exceptional bitch called Harmony. Unfortunately, I was only able to get one litter of pups from her before she actually fell over a high wall running a rabbit hole on top of the high wall. And when she ran into the hole, she fell off. So that was the end of her. But we got one really good litter out of her. There was several of those pups, and I can't remember all of them. I just remember Harmony because that's the one I kept. Mm-hmm. I have one called Melody. Melody was one of them. The females were the dominant dogs in that cross.
Really?
Yeah, the males were decent hounds, but the females were far superior to the males. And so I never even used the males as studs. I went through the female line.
Right, right. Now, you know, let's talk about that for just a second. When we're talking about breeding, and you're gonna know a lot more than myself and a lot of others. When you have that situation where you've got those pups that are born and the females seem to be more prominent or dominant as far as being rabbit dogs and becoming rabbit dogs. Than the males, or vice versa, you have a cross and the males are more than the female. What do you attribute that to besides just genetics? Is that something that you see often one side or the other, or is that something that you rarely seen over your years of breeding?
No, I think that's more prevalent than people ever pick up on because there's something, and you're probably familiar with it, the racehorse people refer to it as the paternal grandsire syndrome, where a dominant sire, an exceptional sire, as an individual, will produce better females than they do males. Now, from the racehorse, in the racehorse world, a horse that many people would recognize readily is Secretariat.
Mm-hmm.
Secretariat was known for that. He had some successful colts, but the mares, and the successful mares also. But his mares, the mares out of him, when bred, produced traits more like Secretariat than he probably did himself. So it like flips a generation sometimes. And then I've seen that very often in dogs. Because there'll be, if you'll look at any of some of my pedigrees, you'll see certain dogs that I only bring in from the bitch line. Round Palm Mr. T, who produced good males. He did. He produced. He at the time I bred to him, he was the top producer in the United States and maybe Canada. I'm not sure, but I liked his male dogs, but I liked his females better. And then when I bred those females to Samson, I always had good crosses. He covered the T bitches exceptionally well.
Mm-hmm.
So. And that, again, that's not to say that T didn't produce well. He did. But for me, for what I was looking for, it worked better through the bitch line. And I can't sit here and tell you an individual, a single individual male that I used. And I owned some at one time or another. I even had a male out of Charlie Butterfield's Rockingham Kate who actually finished for her championship three times over in the States because he just kept running it after she championed. And she was out of Birch Haven Bruiser, which was another star. He was already gone by then, but who was a very good star and a good individual. And actually, Grandpa Mr. T went back to him. He was a grandson of him. But a great grandson, rather. So, you know, it happens.
Yeah,
more than you think.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I've seen it before, and you know, it makes me wonder. You know, or you know, when you see those better females, or you know, and you kind of answered that question for me. When you see that, should you take a chance with the males or the female, whichever ones, you know, seems to be the predominant gender coming out of that particular cross, or should you take a chance with the lesser, or should we always go with what we know? We know that this female is doing good. We know she's a good rabbit dog, and then you breed her. And so do you see that paternal grandsire syndrome, do you see it continue on that line, and that's why you decided to breed off the female lines there?
Well, the female line is extremely important.
Sure.
In producing performance dogs, because I know some people don't pay as much attention to the female line, but I always have, and my contention is that if you got a strong female line, they will carry you unless you do something totally stupid. And they'll probably even carry you the first generation then and make decent dogs. But it's that second generation, if you're out in left field, is going to show up.
Mm-hmm.
But I always go with what I recognize and know, because I found it to be counterproductive to experiment the other direction. If I know it's going to work this way, I'm going to do it,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so there's been several. Now, what you said, do you see that often? And does it carry? Let's go back to my example of Secretariat. Secretariat was out of a stallion called Bold Ruler, and out of a mare called Something Royal. And she was out of a stallion that came from Europe called Prince Quello.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the same way. He was a brood mare producer, although he did have some phenomenal males, like I think Roundtable was one of them. But anyway, long story short, he was known for that also. So, yes, it does carry.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not as dominant. It's a lot of it depends on how you breed them. If you try to enhance that trait, you can, you know. But the main thing is I've always tried to keep in mind is performance.
Yeah.
Don't get so hung up on I'm trying to breed a fancy pedigree and disregard what's in front of you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that paper breeding is messed up a lot of lines over the years. I don't think anybody that knows anything will agree with that. That the, you know, instead of looking at the performance of the two dogs that you're breeding, they're just looking at the pieces of paper. And, you know, a lot of times people call me, and I know you've heard this before, they'll call me and say, hey, I got this pedigree right here. I want to send it to you and see what you think. You know, well, how about send me some videos of the dog running? That's what I want to see. I want to see what the dog's doing. I ain't worried about the papers. They're important, you know, and I'm not getting into the paper versus no paper and all that good stuff. That argument's going to go on for eternity, along with Chevrolet and Ford and everything else. But when we're talking about making rabbit dogs, well, we need to start with a rabbit dog. And you, above all people, know that's mirror breeding, or whatever you want to call it, is so important, because the paperwork at really is a conversation piece, you know, mm-hmm. where what we're going to get and the real effect of the history behind that dog is going to be what you're looking at on the ground that's doing the work and the training that's went in behind that. And so I know that you've had those conversations with people as well, as many people have. But at the same time, it's good to have that paper trail so that we can look back through it. And in our previous conversation, we were talking about percentages. As somebody takes and breaks down the percentages, how much spur, how much Samson, how much this, how much that is in a particular dog. Let's talk five-generation pedigree. Mm-hmm. And you've got Northway Driver, Iceman, or whoever it may be back here in the back, and you break down those percentages. How much effect does that have in your experience? How much effect does those in the fourth and fifth generation have on that front end of the 50-50 split between the sire and the dame there when you make that cross?
Again, I would say that, you have to look at the individual, mm-hmm. because what I've seen so many times is people would say, I'm line breeding off this dog, and they whip out a five generation, and that dog would be there several times in the fourth, fifth generation. But then when I see the dog on the ground, it's like, well, that dog don't even run like that old dog.
Mm-hmm.
That dog did. It don't even act like them. So you can't breed blindly. You have to look at the individuals as they come, because how do you know if you are pulling any of those traits forward?
That's good.
If you don't know nothing about that dog,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or that dog's offspring, how they ran, how they performed. If you don't know nothing about them and you're saying, well, that's line bred off that. Yeah, but does it act like it?
Does it matter? Right.
Does it matter?
Right. Just having the name in there, you know,
it don't mean nothing
if you're not seeing it up on the front end.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, if you're not seeing it on the front end, now how important is that background? To me, it's very important, but yet I have the luxury, I guess. I don't know if anyone would call it luxury now, because the years have passed by quickly. But I have seen dogs in the fifth and sixth and seventh generation. I have seen dogs in the eighth and ninth and maybe even tenth generation of some of my dogs run. And I know how they performed, and I know what they produced.
Yeah.
And sometimes there'll be a dog, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. We was talking about throwbacks, and I said, "Well, I've seen throwbacks from the fifth generation. When you line breed on a certain individual, and the dogs that you're using, the parents and grandparents, because grandparents are very important too. Again, that relates right back to the paternal grandsire syndrome. If you're seeing that in effect." Come in on a pedigree, then the grandparent is extremely important, because it's going to dominate that second generation.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I walked you down a long path there. I don't know if I've answered the question adequately.
I'm right on the path with you, and I'm picking up what you're putting down. I'm following the crumbs right on down the path with you here. So at least I am, and I hope that our listeners are as well, because these are important things, because we get into a lot of, as breeders, you get into a lot of conversations with people about the pedigrees and about genetics and things. And be honest with you, you know, I studied a little bit on genetics, enough to get me in trouble. But understanding how they work, you know, between sex-linked genes, autosomal dominant and recessive. And I studied enough on it, like I said, to get me in trouble. So I try to, like, and obviously if I'm not going to sit down with a geneticist and go toe to toe, because I'll just give them the floor and say, take off and go. I'm right here with you. You know, I'll back you up. But you know, you've been in it. You've seen it. And like you said, there's not a lot of people that can say that they have made crosses where they know what the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th generation looked like on the ground, and then can still see that up on the front end. And I think that's where a great deal of respect for Reffitt's dogs has come from, because, you know, I can watch a dog in the field. I literally can watch a dog, judge a dog, or see a dog in the field. Or if one of my buddies, we're just out pleasure running, and I don't know the dog, but I can watch that dog run, and I can watch that dog hunt, and I can say, how much Reffitt's that dog got in it? Because there's certain traits, and you know it, and hopefully the folks that are listening know, and if you don't know, pay attention to it, because you can see that determination that they have, and they're determined to go into places where there are rabbits, because they recognize with their level of intelligence. And I'm bragging on the bloodline here, because I got a pup down there. He's got quite a bit of Reffitt's in him, and he literally can be going across an open field and see a briar patch, and he recognizes that to be a place where a rabbit lives. I've seen that in his daddy. I've seen that in his granddaddy, you know, that had that same, you know, intellectual ability. Well, you, being the proprietor and the owner of this particular kennel, and these bloodlines that have gone out so many years, having that advantage of knowing what those back generations look like, so you know what you're looking for. This is really good information. It's really good advice to be able to not just say, well, he's in there three times. What good is it? I mean, yeah, it's good that it's there, but can you see it up here on the end now?
That's right. Can you see it on the front end?
Right.
And something you said, let me jump in and say that, and I'll give the floor back to you.
Go ahead.
Is that the way you just described the young male, that's what I look for. Mm-hmm. I look for a dog that won't get out there in the middle of a cow field, a slick cow field, and track all day.
Mm-hmm.
I want one that will look and then go to the most likely spot to jump around. And then when you really turn on is when you get one that will walk up to that and will wind it.
Mm-hmm.
And know whether or not there's a rabbit in there,
whether it need to waste his time or not.
Yeah, because I've had dogs in years past, good dogs, that we would be hunting. That's back when I was gunning a lot. And somebody'd say, put old so-and-so, aren't you going to put old so-and-so in this briar patch? I'm sure there's a rabbit in there. And I'd break down and I'd say, well, okay. And I'd say, get on in there and check it out. I've never seen one of these dogs jump a rabbit
after they've winded it.
Yeah, they make me look like a fool. And so I just, if you got a good dog, trust them.
Right.
They'll teach you more than you know.
Oh, well, you know, I'm glad you said that, because Pap used to say, you know, if you know you got a good dog, and so trust your dogs. And if it's a day where those dogs aren't just, they're not feeling it, or they seem like things aren't just, they probably can't smell nothing, and they're not going to go waste their time about it. They might go hit a lick here or there, or whatever. Take them out on a good day. Pap used to say, they're smarter than you are, and they know the job better than you know it. And so you got a good dog, trust your dog. If he says ain't a rabbit in there, keep moving.
And you know, I like the dogs that hunt even on a bad day, but
yeah,
and they'll give you everything they got, but you got to recognize if there's no scent there, then they can only do what their nose will allow them to do.
That's right.
And you got to make allowances. You got to be as intelligent as the dog, at least, in order to be successful.
Right.
Anyway.
And
yes.
and knowing you pack and all, I don't know where my Percy dog got it from. But I know back in his pedigree was Samson and Sarah too, Black Magic. These are all Reffitt's dogs for those of you. And then, you know, Heather, Heather was his grandma. But he had just like this instinctive ability to just know where to go to. I mean, you could take him, drive him 100 miles and turn him out and he would just know where to go to find a rabbit. And I see that in his offspring. I see it in his grandpups. Yeah. And so that kind of makes me, you know, it ain't all about me here, y'all. This is about Dexter Revis, but kind of makes me feel good about how I moved that line forward beyond him. He's passed on now, but how I moved it on beyond him, because I still see that trait. And that's not what Mike Green done. This is what Dexter Revis did, you know, in the past, to make these crosses and to line it up and to still be able to see it beyond the next generation or two. And so with all that and the knowledge that you have about making these crosses and what you're looking for, so is it safe to say that your main reason for crossing two dogs was because of the dogs and not so much exactly as heavy weighted as what was behind them?
Yes, that's true. Now, because I breed a family of dogs, and it's taken years to develop the dogs, you know, initially though, the parents and the grandparents, I like to know how those dogs acted. Because let's think about it, Mike. If, you know, some people have, I haven't. I've never seen a completely perfect dog.
No, right.
They all have maybe not a fault, but because we won't say they have faults. They have weaknesses somewhere. And you as the owner, or even as if you're going to use that dog, you got to look for that. Because if you don't recognize it, what weakness may be there, then how are you going to fix it?
Right, right. So well, I kind of fill in the hole.
Yeah, and so you look for, in my breeding, I look for a family member, and I've done various crosses. We won't even. That's another topic, is line breeding, inbreeding, family breeding. But you look to where you can strengthen that from another individual in the same family. And that's another thing I would say, is that I never want a cookie cutter type of group of animals, because they're just individuals like you and I are, and I'm sure that you're probably different from your brothers and sisters.
Oh, definitely. I am the gem of the litter.
You are the diamond, right?
Yeah, I hope my brother's listening to this.
But you look to another member of that family to strengthen that. Because the goal is to get the most positive traits in one individual that you can.
Right.
And then I would also say, and still produce a high percentage of rabbit dogs. Because I would stress to anybody, instead of trying to make crosses to try to produce one superstar, and knowing that most of them won't make it, I think as a breeder, it's our responsibility to produce a well-balanced litter of pups for all of them, or at least most of them. Well, my percentages are high. I look for a bunch of them to make at least good, solid rabbit dogs. And if you will continue to do that, the superstars will crop out.
Absolutely.
And that a dog out of a litter like that is much more likely to reproduce his likeness than an outcross where you just happen to hit it right.
Right, right. And I'll be honest with you, I've been lucky a few times, and then not be able to reproduce that on the next generation. And that's probably been the problem, you know.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you look for a strong family, because if they don't have a strong family to support them, then they really have no ability to produce in the next generation, because if they were a fluke, then they're not going to be able to produce that.
Right. That's right. Cause it's just not there. It's not there for them to pass on, right?
It's not there to pass on.
Mm.
And if you really want to get into genetics, a dog like that, their phenotype is not the same as their genotype.
That's right. Look, yeah, we got to cut down on them big words, but we'll be look, you lose me. But yeah, I understand though. I do. I understand completely that family idea. I like that. You know, all the breeding I've done, and I have kept it in a good solid, you know, family group of dogs that are reproducing and doing well. Even with that, I've come out, you know, and kept a whole litter, and I got this whole litter, and I'm looking at the dogs, and I'm looking like, where'd you come from? You know, this one or two pups is, they're just not clicking like the other two or three in the litter, you know, when they get on up, you know, starting age and all. But still, I like what you said. It's a really good idea to keep that in a strong family group. That's bringing that out.
Yes.
Now, was that something that you kind of just evolved to, or you kind of just learned as you went through trial and error, or was it something that somebody taught you along the way? How did you come to that point to say, you know what, we need to keep it in the family here? You know.
Well. Go ahead. I interrupt.
No. Well, you know, it's kind of, that's my question. You know, how did you decide? Because when I look back through some pedigrees and I see Heather and Samson and going back. And one of the questions I had from somebody that was, asked him, what was it about the Northway dogs that he liked so much? And how did he keep that going? You know, so I know that's two questions, but, you know, did you come up with that whole family concept idea of that? How did you come to that point?
Well, that was observation.
Mm-hmm.
One thing was, as a child and a young man, I saw people who had really nice hounds here in the mountains. And this wasn't beagles, this was big hounds, this was coon hounds, fox hounds, that before they would breed within the family, they would outcross to an inferior dog just so they wouldn't breed close. And I've seen good families of hounds totally bred out by doing that. And you talked about paper dogs versus grade dogs. Well, I was fortunate, I guess, in that when I was a child, there was not that much influence from outside dogs.
Right.
Not like it is now. So I could recognize families of dogs that different families had. And, you know, they were family bred. But then with the influx of new bloodlines and everybody wanting to cross and so forth, and I saw entire lines of dogs bred out and destroyed by doing that. And then In the coonhound world, the coonhound world was a little more progressive, I think. Although, I mean, you touched on this basically, you have to admit that the brace people were successful in what they set out to do.
That's true.
And they used primarily inbreeding in their efforts to slow those dogs down and get them down to the point they got them. But in the coonhound world, they had been a little more progressive in their thought process for years. And I started recognizing that in the coonhound world. And then I was fortunate enough as a young teen to have conversations with a coon hunter called Dave Dean, who had the Hammer Northern Blue Hammer line. And he bred those extensively. Now, for years he dominated the scene with the Hammer dogs. He pretty much revolutionized the blue tick coonhound. And then in his later years, you know, as with a lot of breeders, he gets old, and the later hounds, I don't know much about them. But those early dogs, like 2 and 3 and 5 and 7 and 8 and just keep on going. But he utilized that type of breeding program. And then a lot of the Walker breeders were very, and even some of the English breeders. I was fortunate to be able to visit with Bert Noni in the English. I've been to his, was at his kennel when I was in my teens, and you know, sold Drum and Racket and all of those old dogs. I didn't get to see Van Zant Sam, but anyway.
Wow, I ain't heard those names in a long time.
I'm old, man.
The coon hunters out there, they'll know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but, you know, it's all of the coonhound breeds had families of dogs. And, well, look at the plot dogs. They were. You know, so it was observation and not only just observing, but seeing those dogs in action and seeing that it worked. And when I first started breeding my beagles that way, everybody said, that boy's inbreeding them dogs to death. But I never wavered. I stayed the course.
Stayed the course. He's inbreeding the fire. What'd you tell me the other night? If you went outside of it, you was out crossing them to death.
Yeah, that's what I said. They initially said he's inbreeding them to death, and then when I would go and breed to something like Round Pond Mr. T or something, or in later years even got acquired Iron Eagle, they would say, oh, he's out crossing them to death. I'm like, hey, boys, you can't have it both ways.
I can't do it two ways. What's going on here?
But when I would step out, then I would evaluate the offspring and see if I was successful in what I was trying to accomplish. And then the challenge, well, first of all, by luck or more, I think you and I know there is really no luck. There's the grace of God.
No, it's God all the way, brother.
By the grace of God, if God blessed me, which he has blessed me much more than I ever deserved, but if I was successful, then the challenge comes in bringing those crosses back into the line and retaining the traits that you were successful in acquiring. The second generation and the third generation tells the tale.
Right.
And if you can carry it into the third, you've pretty much, you're getting close to getting it set.
And that's tough to do.
It's tough, and there's heartaches, and there's failures.
Yeah.
It's like what we were talking about the other night. That and again, I'm not calling myself a master by any means, but the difference between a master and a novice is a master has failed more times than the novice has ever tried.
I got that wrote down right here. Yep. I'm going to use that on my employees. So, but you're right. You're right. Time, failure, trial and error. That's what's got you there.
Let me jump in and say this. You can use this on your employees. The only person or hound that never makes a mistake is the one that doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm. That's a fact. That's a fact.
If I know my hound and I know what's happening, if they make a little bobble and I recognize why, maybe it's trying to please me too hard or whatever, at least they're trying.
That's right.
Instead of that dog laying out there in the weeds or walking the path. I mean, get in there and do something. Don't stand around me. I don't tolerate that long.
No, and you know, some of my running buddies, they give me a hard time and stuff. But you know, if I have a young dog that comes that goes into cutover, and they come out on the other end of it looking at a white-tailed deer, at least they went in there looking. And now I got something that'll break them from that. You know, I can straighten them out on that end.
The shock collar is the greatest thing ever happened to hound people. See, when I started, and when I was Kuna, and when I started running rabbit dogs, the shock collar use was very limited. I didn't have one for years. And they were so big and bulky that, my God, you put it on a little beagle and he'd run sideways. You went and caught them off the deer. You tried to find where they was crossing, and you caught them off the deer. You know, most young dogs will try you.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a whole different subject about philosophy of the pack. But
yeah,
and we won't get into that because we could talk about that for hours. But a dog that has a lot of go to him and tries they'll bump some trash when they're young. What I look for is the dog that's easy to break off.
That's right. Intelligence.
Intelligence. Mm-hmm. Now, I have had a handful of dogs that were natural straight.
Yep.
And still were good dogs. But a lot of people, when they say, oh, I got a natural straight dog, well, when you go watch that dog run, typically you're thinking to yourself, yeah, I know why it's straight, because it won't run nothing.
That's right. He ain't done nothing.
He ain't done nothing. He's walking here with us. Yeah, he's natural straight. He won't run nothing.
Well, I can say, my Percy dog, my Maggie dog, that have, and I joke with my buddy Ken. You know Ken. I joke with Ken all the time. You know, Percy died last year. Matter of fact, the 14th of January 2023, he passed away. Percy never run nothing in his life. Never run nothing in his life that was wrong. But one time, and I say never, but you know what I mean. He was hunting behind me and Stacy Smith were hunting behind a woman's house right there, and he come out looking at a black cat.
Yeah.
And you know, I shocked him and he was sorry for it and all that. But, you know, he never ran a whitetail. He never run a bobcat. He never run a coyote. He never run a hog. And, you know, he never run anything but rabbit. And he had that instinctive. I mean, when he went in there looking for a rabbit, he come out looking at a cat. I mean, it was just, hey, look, that's just like the eternal natural process, dog chase cat, you know? So,
oh, yeah. I mean, I've had beagles that wouldn't chase a cat, but I've had some that loved them. They would. You had to break them off from them.
Right. I had a Reference dog one time. I was running a hunt, and I was up north running a hunt, and it was a cat climbed down out of a tree. I seen the cat climb down out of the tree, and it hit the mm-hmm. ground right there, and I didn't say nothing. I just stood there. I was hoping all the rest of them would see that, and my dog came back to me, you know, he came back to me, and the rest of them went down that way. One guy said, there's a cat over there, and I was like, well, it's fair game. so look, I'm not hoping you lose, but I don't want you to win. The cat's on my side. So, but yeah, you know, and having that drive and determination to run the game that they're trained to run on, you know, the intelligence to be able to bring that back around, to be able to please you. And there again, they're not going to do anything wrong standing in the road, but at the whole time they're doing something wrong. You know,
yes.
Well, it's kind of like the Bible says, you know, that we're all falling, right? And the man that says that he's not is extra falling. You know, the man says he don't sin is sinning by saying he don't sin. And so a dog that's standing in the road saying, hey, I ain't doing nothing wrong. But yeah, you are wrong because you're not doing what you've been trained or at least bred to do.
That's the greatest sin. That's the greatest sin right there that they could do. Right.
And the thing is when we're out and we're soloing dogs or we're working bracing two dogs together, you know, we always try to put, you know, this more experienced dog with that one and let that one show this one and they'll work together and that process works great. But there's a lot to be said about that one dog that one rabbit and the things that rabbit can teach him. And then all the other stuff that he encounters while he's out there, but yet still operates to try to overtake that game. And that comes back to the breeding. It comes back to the intelligence and the training. So what's the when, you know, as far as training and all the breeding that you've done and you came up. Well, hold on a second. I got a note right here. Sorry about that. Let me go back to this right here right quick.
Go ahead.
Got a question about Round Pond Mr. T.
All right.
How come we don't see him in a whole lot more? And I don't know if you can answer this question, but you would know better than I would know. Why is it that we don't see him in a lot more pedigrees? Then even back years ago than what we do, is it because he wasn't bred a lot or was it improper breeding or to just, you know, what's the deal with Round Pond Mr. T? And I know you bred Chime to him. So obviously, you know, he was a sure enough reproducer. And like you said, he was what, the best reproducer in the nation.
He was the top for, 2 or 3 years there. And I lost count of how many champions he produced, but it was in the 30-some percentile.
Yeah.
Or 30-some number-wise. I think it's 30, 35, 36. That's a good question. Now, you do see him back way back in some degrees.
I guess my question is why didn't – and who owned Round Pond, Mr. T? Let me make sure I get the name right.
Tom Sharp.
All right. So, Mr. Sharp, reckon – all right. So, because, like, I've got a what's that dog's name in one of my pedigrees as well? Mrs. T.
Is it Birch Lake Mrs. T?
Yeah, Birch Lake Mrs. – man, you're good. Birch Lake Mrs. T. Is that any kin to dogs? Any kin to him?
No.
Okay. So, then that brings me to this question – Was he never line bred out to keep that prevalent, or was it just not possible to hold on to it for very long? What was the deal there? Or at least, you know, what do you think?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us this week on the Fueled by Joy Working Dog Podcast. That will conclude part one with Mr. Dexter, and it was fantastic. Make sure and tune in next week for part two. And as always, Tree Dog Tuesday on Tuesday. And remember, check out Painstream Media on YouTube. Some more fantastic content there, as well as early access to all the Fueled by Joy Working Dog podcasts. So thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.